committee. First, I'd like to address a couple of administrative items. The first is the approval of the agenda. Are there any objections? If not, I would like to have a motion to approve the agenda.
So moved.
Second.
Questions? Seeing no questions, all in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Abstentions? Good. The next item that we have is the approval of the minutes from the December 13th meeting. I'd like to have a motion to approve the minutes from the December 13th meeting.
So moved.
Second.
Questions, objections? Okay, we have a vote. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Abstentions?
Abstain.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Okay. All righty. We'd like to now move to the two core items in our for our agenda today. The first being the bus transformation study update. We'll have Rob Fuentes, chair of the Executive Steering Committee, and Richard Davey here to give us an update on the study, the goals and the objectives, and sort of give us a preview. Again, I'm excited about what you're doing. Look forward to hearing your observations. I know you need to give us practical things that we can do in terms of the limitations and jurisdictional issues, but I'm also hoping that you will give us some things that are going to be eye-opening and push us, because a few years ago, if someone said we were going to have dedicated funding, they probably said that would have been impossible. So in two or three years, maybe some of these ideas here that people today say are impossible, maybe possible. So we're going to ask you to push our thinking about what is possible, what is doable, and where we should be going. And then after this presentation, we're going to have Laura Mason, the Metro's acting assistant general manager for rail. She's going to respond to a request from the committee, and that was, if you recall, management came forth with a recommendation that we maintain the current hours, and what we asked management to do would be to look at some alternatives. Are there some other ways that we can meet our requirements in terms of safety, in terms of reliability, so that we have a fuller understanding? Now, these two items are open for discussion. There is no decision to be made at this meeting. Mr. General Manager, when we get to the hours discussion, would appreciate it if you would just share an overview of the letter that you received from the Federal Transit Authority, and sort of what does that mean in terms of as we frame our conversation. So with these, we'll first begin with members of our committee being able to ask questions, and then we will open it more broadly to other members of the board, give them an opportunity to ask questions. So I said a lot. Let me stop and turn it over to you.
If I may just make a few comments first on the bus transformation study. Let me just give a little bit of background. The bus industry across the country is facing challenges, particularly on lost ridership. There's a lot of factors playing out, and they're playing out here in this region as well, particularly the change in marketplace that we're all facing. And clearly it has cost implications as ridership goes down, what that does. And then we have the added complexity here of the 3% cap. So these are things that led to some of our thinking to start this effort. We started talking about this last summer, and we started thinking through it. And when we looked around the country, traditionally the approach to look at bus-related issues is sort of start off, well, this is where the streetcar used to go, and things have changed, and why don't we look at the routes, and we change the routes, which is important. But we thought it was much larger than that. So our approach was to take a much larger perspective and think of how bus fits into the new mobility paradigm that we all live in. And then within that, what does Metro Bus convening our role play in that effort. The other thing that, so that was sort of a little bit different than what historically had been done, although other properties around the country are starting to think of it that way as well. And then the other thing that we wanted to do was we felt this should not be a staff-driven initiative because it's much larger than just us. And that so we reached out to different community leaders and just sort of to the region. And we created a process that tries to get this from a regional dialogue and eventually a regional consensus. And then our portion of it would obviously come to the board. So Rob here at the Eno Foundation stepped up and took the lead in the chair in a group, which he'll talk about in briefly. And then we did bring in some consultant help for him, which Rich Davey, who you know, has done some other work for the board to assist them. We kicked it off in September, and if they'll walk through what they've done to date. And really for the board, the implications for us are really for the 2021 budget. And that's how we've timed this. Yeah, as you know, in the 20 budget, we're not, you know, getting into a lot of the bus-related issues, but they will need to be addressed in the 21 budget. So that's really what this is also leading to from the board's perspective. So with that, I'll turn it over to Rob and Rich.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I appreciate your comments at the outset. The purpose of this project is to develop a very bold and collaborative strategy for bus in the region. So I can tell you that the attitude from folks on the Executive Steering Committee are very consistent with your comments. No one wants this to be just another exercise. This is happening in cities and metropolitan areas all across the country. And as they're grappling with the challenges that Paul mentioned at the beginning, declining ridership, kind of reinventing what's going on, there are a lot of interesting and innovative strategies that are being tried. Major redesigns, infrastructure investments, governance reforms, all these things are happening around the country. So it's a very interesting time to be doing that. What this project is trying to do is take a step back and try to figure out what are these changes that are going on around the country or around the region. How is bus affected by that? Specifically, then, how is Metro bus affected by that? So it's actually trying to get a handle on all that first before we get into some of those tactics. That's going to come. And the idea is for it to be bold and aggressive, like you said. But we really want to do this collaborative effort to understand what's happening and how does the region then think about bus in light of all of these changes. It really is a very exciting time to be working in transportation. This is a perfect project for that. And it's a really great team that's working on this stuff now, led by Rich Davies and Ray Davey at the Boston Consulting Group. So we'll turn over to him for most of the presentation.
Thanks, Rob. Appreciate it. Maybe we'll just go to slide two then. So just for today's objectives, and there's a lot of material in front of you, I'll move through some of it quickly because we do want to hear from the board in terms of the committee for questions or advice to the extent that you wish to share it today. I want to briefly provide an overview and background on bus in the region today. Sort of what's the state of affairs today? Give you an overview of the project in terms of governance, project goals, and stakeholder engagement. It's something when I spoke to some board members back in the fall, very attuned to making sure that we were pitching a big tent, if you will, to make sure the region was weighing in. And I think it's fair to say we've done that and we'll continue to do that over the coming months. Highlight where we've landed in terms of what we think the strategic choices are, and then finally talk to you a little bit about some next steps. So in the next slide, talk a little bit about the overview of the region, and on slide three, you know, just briefly, obviously bus is an integral part of the transportation network here. It's efficient, most efficient surface transportation, obviously reduces roadway congestion, emissions, it's an affordable mobility option, and obviously it's providing access to folks across the region. Slide four, just, you know, who's on the bus, who's actually taking, and this is not just Metro bus per se, but certainly the first one it is, almost half of Metro bus customers are low income, which is defined as living in a household with an income of less than $30,000 a year, so definitely low income. 55% of Metro bus customers have no vehicle at home, so this is their primary form of transportation. And a pretty diverse in terms of the region. About half live in the district, and the other third live in Maryland, and about 16% are in Virginia. Next slide. Interesting where we've looked at some trace model data. I mentioned this to a couple folks already, that in some respects, bus and rail may be a bit two different systems. 85% of bus customers use bus to their final destinations. They actually don't transfer to rail. And this is, again, across the region. This is all buses, not just Metro bus. And about half of bus customers are using it at times outside of your typical commuting period. So they're not peak riders. These are folks using the system in late morning, early afternoon, weekend, et cetera. So not your typical rail, you know, classic peak commuters, if you will. So a more diverse ridership, and in fact, you know, they have different needs than your rail customers, it seems. Next slide. I'm going to quickly show you just four maps to give you a sense for the scope of what bus operates today. This is what Metro Bus operates. This is throughout the region. Next slide. This gives you a sense for what the non-regional routes that Metro Bus operates overlay to your regional routes. Next slide. This is all the bus routes that you do not operate around the system, and obviously with your partner providers in the counties and the jurisdictions. And then the last slide shows you the entire scope of bus service in the region. Obviously some overlap, but it gives you a sense for how wide and the breadth of the service that's provided across the region. Next slide. Just some facts and figures. You know, there's about 620,000 bus riders in the region, if you will, about 43,000 of those are on Metro Bus. This gives you a sense for the route sizes, the fleet, the cost, and what types of services are offered. Currently, local services are offered, of course, by all providers. There are some quarter-type services provided by most. And then special services, airport, late night, offered by just a handful. So, again, a pretty diverse group of operators operating various services across the region. Next slide. And this is just a brief overview of the funding sources and decisions, or funding, I should say, and service decisions based on the definitions of regional versus non-regional. It's a bit complicated. But interjurisdictional connections or services that are serving a COG regional activity center, significant travel, or achieves a cost effectiveness, essentially a super-regional bucket. And non-regional is essentially anything else that isn't that, that you're operating. Why is this important? The subsidy and formula allocation is different. And I think that's one thing this study will unpack, is to try to think about perhaps a more transparent way to actually fund bus services in the region. Next slide. A few findings. I'm sure this won't surprise you, but despite the reach of bus, all providers, including Metro Bus, are having some challenges. The bus speed is declining. I'll talk about why that's important in a minute. Bus ridership is declining, as the general manager said, not necessarily endemic here to the region, but most other providers in the United States. In fact, around the world, even Transport for London, for example, which I think is held up as one of the best systems in the world, is also experiencing a drop in bus ridership, even though they have made significant investment in bus over the last several years. And then lastly, the mounting pressure on the operating model. Obviously, with the 3% cap, that's important. But even without that, you are having cost pressures with dropping ridership and increasing costs to provide the service. Next slide. This is the point I wanted to make a little bit about why slowing buses are actually increasing your costs. So 10 years ago, the average speed of a bus was 11 miles an hour. It's 10 now. It seems insignificant, but in fact, that 9% drop is costing you about $30 million. So imagine $30 million alone and associated savings. You could invest back into better bus service. You could use that to address the 3% cap, for example. And there are lots of reasons for that. Increased congestion, off-street parking, curbside development, slack of enforcement. But again, not only is it an inconvenience to your customers, it's clearly an operating cost issue. Next slide. And then ridership is obviously increasingly dropped. We don't have the 2018 numbers yet. I will work with Paul and his team to get that. But we've seen a ridership decline across the region, as I should say, not just Metro Bus, of about 13% over the last 5 years. Next slide. And at the same time, again, not a surprise, but just to level set, your operating loss has grown 3.7% since 2013. Obviously, this comes to even more light with your 3% cap. If you're increasing your operating losses at this kind of a clip, it is obviously going to be a significant challenge as you focus on your 3% cap. Next slide. And just three major factors that's contributing to your cost growth: increase in personnel costs, about 80% or $80 million of the total increase over those 5 years, including salary, fringe, and overtime expenses. High percentage of time miles spent on deadhead. Deadhead is the industry term, which means you are operating a bus without any passengers on it, because it's going from usually its bus depot or garage to the first stop on a route. Actually a bit higher than most of your peers. That's largely due to location. It could be some work rules with labor, but certainly there's a built-in cost there. And then, as we mentioned, declining bus fees, again, increasing your costs. Next slide. Please. Principally, yes. There's a very marginal cost savings on fuel, very marginal, but it's almost all personnel. That's exactly right. So, you know, you've got to deal with that in two ways, right? You're either extending the pick time and the route time because you've seen this reduction in speed, or you're not, and you're paying folks for time, for example. So you're sort of caught, it's a catch-22 if you, from an operating perspective and from a budget perspective. Sure. Next slide. And again, just to sort of put a bow on this, but what are the mounting pressures in your operating model? Certainly the 3% cap is a significant challenge. And it's difficult to achieve in the current service model, right? So with the 3% cap, you're seeing obviously your operating losses grow at a higher rate. Something has got to give, if you will, to make that work. And look, and we haven't talked about the customer either, right? I mean, certainly we've done a customer survey. We'll talk a little bit about that, but there's a clear, from what we've heard from customers, both your regional and jurisdictional partners, but customers taking the bus on a regular basis, they want more, they want better service, more frequent. So thinking about how you're doing all of this with the 3% cost challenge is fairly daunting. Next slide. With that said, why we're here, part of what Rob and the steering committee have asked the consulting team to do is really look at how can we derive maximum value from the existing roadway today. There are certainly tactics and techniques which can do that. How are we better matching service and demand? Bus is no longer, I think, a 40-foot vehicle that runs on a fixed route every 10 or 15 minutes. You're seeing lots of other options in the mobility ecosystem for customers now, so thinking about that, what that definition. And then speeding up point-to-point travelers, again, improving the customer experience, but also actually reducing your operating costs if you can increase speeds. So how are we going to do that? Well, we're looking at changes in governance, funding structure, political priorities, frankly, political will to make some of these changes. Knowing that, in many respects, Metro does not control the infrastructure in which you run. And so this will have to be a concerted effort, not only with folks in this room, but those outside the room, frankly, those who the board represent in your respective jurisdictions. We stop there. See if there are any other questions. Not keeping
Mr. Chair. Rich or Rob, what about the impact of SafeTrack and some of the other work-related activities that are going on right now? Did they factor in at all to your, some of the information you're presenting here today?
In terms of bus ridership, I think the answer is yes. But, as we pointed out, about 85% of your riders are actually using bus only, not rail, right? So certainly there are some rail, and Paul probably speaks to this or his team, there are definitely routes that are feed rail that you've seen a reduction in ridership. There's no doubt about that.
Right, we have a lot of that.
But I think net-net is probably beyond just the track work, safe track that you've done for a variety of reasons.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, in about 3 minutes, and I think Rob will talk a little bit about what we've done in terms of the project. We will, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Just briefly. Oh, sorry.
Mr. Chairman, may I ask a question? You referenced earlier that I think around 50%
of the riders were low-income. And I think you said that's not just Metrobus, but a number for all bus systems in the area.
Correct.
And then in the small print, I saw you had a 30,000 cutoff as what your definition is. Is that a federal definition, a local definition that qualifies for aid to dependent children? Where is that 30,000 figure coming from?
I think that was just a figure that we chose for purposes of this study. I'm not sure it was a federal definition, for example, or anything reflective. I mean, you know, one could argue that 30,000 is extremely low, right? 40, 50,000 may be low in the region given the costs. So,
I mean, that's where I was going to, and I was going to suggest perhaps you could also dig into that number and maybe give us the number of the number below the Medicaid standard, which seems to be the quote, poverty level trigger for eligibility for Obamacare.
And we that might be
a better, better sense of a broadly accepted federal definition of people who are low income.
We can certainly cut and slice that, for sure. Suffice to say, it's a real lifeline for, you know, a number of folks here in the region. But we can certainly come back to you with some other slices of you know, who are your customers, for sure. Maybe just go to slide 20. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just want to briefly talk about a couple of case studies. I know the board has often asked in the past for what are other folks doing as maybe lodestars or at least some ideas about how Metro should be proceeding. You know, there are some national trends that transit agencies are trying to solve in different ways. The general manager mentioned this earlier. Improving bus speeds by providing dedicated lanes, signal priority, other treatments. In fact, you know, there are other regional providers here in this region that are doing that, obviously. Redesigning bus networks, which I would want to jump to conclusions, but I will assume will probably be one of the recommendations that's made by the steering committee, that given the strategic principles, one of the roadmap items is for would be for the Metro Bus to really redesign its network in the coming months and year. And then lastly, increasing frequency and expanding service to some new areas. That's been another tactic that other agencies have used. I'll explain that in a moment. Next slide. So just, again, very briefly, TriMet in Portland really made investing in and prioritizing bus in Portland a top priority. You know, quickly the outcomes with that, they saw a 10% improvement in travel time, and also a savings of about $13 million over 8 years. Next slide. King County in Metro and in Seattle is probably the one agency in the last few years in the United States that's actually seen an increase in ridership. Really not a lot of secret sauce. They've added a lot more services, what they've done, and they've prioritized bus in the downtown Seattle area. They obviously also have significant annual funding improvement as well in the region. The region voted for increased taxes to invest into transit, which included bus. Typically, these investments you see are focused on rail or heavy capital intensive programs, but Seattle is committed to moving folks. I think if you call it the old-fashioned way, which also probably the most cost-effective way, which was investing in its bus service. Next slide. In the Bay Area, a governance body with a broad authority. The MTC plays a coordinating role across all of the transit entities in the Bay Area and also the nine counties. This has worked fairly well from a governance perspective. They also have the ability to use surplus toll revenue. They exercise discretion over the selection of capital projects as well. An example of good governance across in the United States. And the last one, just to mention, I think, is TfL, Transport for London, as I mentioned. While they are now seeing a beginning a dip in ridership and bus, when they made the initial investment 10 years ago, or approximately 10 years ago, in anticipation of essentially congestion pricing in London, they saw a significant increase in bus service, reduction in traffic, greenhouse gas emissions, et cetera. They are now attempting to implement the Mayor of London's goal, which is to go to zero emission buses all by 2037. Interestingly enough, by the way, their model is they contract out all of their bus service they run, none of it. They have 20 different providers. and they bid it. They bid these routes actually on a weekly basis. Sort of interesting, model. And then lastly, as the general manager mentioned, you know, there are a number of systems. Baltimore, of course, the most recent and closest that have looked at improving their bus network. These tend to be, I would say, a little easier to accomplish, given that a number of these regions have one single bus operator, as opposed to here in the region where you've got multiple bus operators. They went to a network review. As the general manager mentioned, I think it was probably the right approach for Metro to first ask the question, what are we trying to solve for? Once you answer that question, then you begin to look at what routes, what bus, where the buses should go, what bus stops should go, et cetera. I'm going to stop there and turn it over to Ron to talk a little bit about the project itself, and Chairman, to your point, talk a little bit about some of the stakeholder needs.
Thank you. So you can see there's been a lot of work that's gone into this so far. The quantitative stuff is very important, especially for the committee, so we get all on the same page about exactly what is going on with bus in the region. So I'm just going to touch quickly on this, what the overview of the project is. Next slide, please. As you mentioned at the beginning, this isn't happening in isolation. We're not just jumping into tactics for improving bus service in the region. It's starting out with a recognition of the mobility changes that are happening, not just in this region, but around the country and around the world, but particularly here in this region. And then recognizing, as Rich was showing, that Metro Bus is not the only provider in the region. In a lot of places, it's at other parts of the region, other providers have a very strong role to play. So recognizing the context of bus in the region and then zeroing in then on that target there in the middle of then specifically what is the role for Metro Bus, what is that going to look like in the near future and off in the distance. So in terms of the governance, next slide, please. As I said, I'm chairing this executive steering committee, which is made up of it's really sophisticated folks from all around the region, not all super transportation dorks like me, but civic leaders who recognize that bus has a strong role to play, and I can say that there is tons and tons of good ideas. We'll talk about that in just a second. But it's not just the committee. There is a leadership team here at the agency. There's a strategic advisory panel and a technical team that are made up of a lot of the local staff and local officials. We have a tremendously talented transportation brain trust here in the region of folks in the jurisdictions, tapping them to serve on these committees, and then a lot of the organizations that are here in the region, other regional stakeholders, making sure that they're part of this process as well. Next slide, please. So where we are, we're here in the second phase of this process. We've gone through, I think what Rich was calling kind of the happy phase, the first part, the mom and apple pie part, where folks were kind of talking about what we thought bus should look like, very positive, very affirmative. And I can tell you there's a lot of interest in making sure that bus is as functioning as well as it can be. We are now moving into the second phase where we're starting to make harder choices about, okay, recognizing we can't do everything, and even though we have a lot of great ideas, how do we start to prioritize really where we need to be? That's the phase that we're in right now, moving into the spring and then the summer, which is going to be much more specific, putting together those strategies and then putting together the roadmap there by the end of the summer and into the fall. But it's designed to be very action-oriented, and it's, as you can see, a very linear kind of process. Next slide, please. So the project goals, the vision for the project is that bus is going to be the mode of choice for the region's roads by 2030, so a very big, bold, and ambitious plan. Serving as the backbone of a strong and inclusive regional mobility system. So nobody thinks bus is going away. We do think probably bus is changing somehow. We don't know exactly what that's going to look like, but we do think that bus should play a very strong role in the region's mobility in the coming years. Next slide, please. As was talked about, the stakeholder input has been very very positive, and I think what folks are looking for, they're clearly looking for bus to provide this regional connectivity, not just for folks who depend on it, but for folks who have discretion for how they get around. Improving the rider experience, sometimes bus can not have that great experience, so making sure that it really does provide the same kind of services that we're used to around the region. Clearly recognizing the financial stewardship of bus that the committees in particular are very cognizant of the resource constraints. We'll talk about that in just a second. That's connected to sustainable economic health, and that social equity is a major concern. These aren't really prioritized, but these are pervasive themes that have emerged as we've gone through this process so far. Next slide. So as the chair mentioned, there's been extensive stakeholder outreach in this effort. This is not something that's being cooked up in a conference room, or not something that's being just cooked up by the executive committee, you know, as a top-down kind of thing. There's been extensive outreach to folks all around the region. You can see some of the stats here. They're hard for me to read in the slide. But lots of enthusiastic responses. Folks are very willing to provide their opinions about BUS in the region. So you can imagine that we've received lots and lots of feedback from folks. Next slide. For a recap of it, there's been the surveys that have gone out to lots of folks around the region, lots of different events, way more responses than was expected. I think the goal was for 3,000. We had almost 6,000 responses. And so while it was wide distribution, we really wanted to focus on folks who do ride bus frequently across the region. So it's not just folks with an opinion, but folks who are actually customers of the service. Next slide. As Rich was touching on, and others, you may recognize the survey results do talk about some of the things that we've already kind of hit on. Folks are looking for more efficient, more frequent, more reliable service. That's not hard to understand, but it came out very clearly in the survey results. More frequent service is, as you can see there, was number one. But reliability and so forth are clearly things that folks are looking for. A lot of things that we talk about and a lot of the tactics for bus ridership about make it less confusing and information. Those are appeared on this chart, but they're not the number one thing that folks were looking for. We'll talk about that in a second. Next slide, please. So in terms of the reasons for people riding the bus, we know that people believe that it's the best option, that it's the most close option, the most convenient option for folks to getting from home or work. It's often the most affordable option for a lot of folks, and it's easy to use. The bus network is pretty clear in that regard. The reasons for not riding the bus, though, are kind of the flip side of that. It comes too infrequently. Folks can't get on the bus. They're not going to ride it. It's too slow. It doesn't go where we need to go. So it's really honing in on this larger point about reliability, frequency, and convenience, which really seem to be these overarching concerns. Next slide. As was mentioned, there's lots of changes in bus use that's happening in the region, but the riders are not uniform. Right? I mean, people ride the bus for lots of different reasons. Why people are not riding the bus are, you know, for lots of different reasons. But we are seeing different changes based on different different user experiences. So people who depend on the bus and who do ride it frequently are actually taking it more in a lot of cases. So we can dig into a lot of these stats in a little bit, but it's important to recognize that when we look at these ridership statistics, which, as GM was mentioning at the beginning, is very consistent around the country. All riders are not the same, and their experiences are very, very different. Next slide, please. What we're doing now, actually is going on pretty much this week and all throughout this month, is stakeholder outreach, particularly to elected officials. They've been going on now for a couple of weeks with advisory, the steering committee folks and folks from the different committees, reaching out very specifically to city and county officials throughout the region, getting their perspectives, making sure that they're comfortable with the project, they understand what we're doing here, and then soliciting their advice and their thoughts and their ideas for what we should be doing with this project. And I personally have been very impressed so far with the conversations. As I said, there's a high level of sophistication in this region. And I do work across the country. It's not always the case. But people know what we're trying to do here. They have very strong opinions for what to do. The challenge isn't going to be soliciting ideas. The challenge is going to be weeding through them and trying to figure out what is the best and the most appropriate. There's also outreach that's going on to congressional delegations. That's happening later this month. So, happening soon. Let me turn over then to Rich to end up here with strategic choices.
Just the last slide I want to anchor on is really the five strategic choices that we've worked with all the committees that Rob mentioned, the Executive Steering Committee, the leadership team, the technical team, and our public survey. We've really anchored on these five questions to begin to answer that will anchor the strategy. So, you know, what is the role of bus in the region, and how can we rethink that term, not just a 40-foot fixed route service, but customers are demanding more, they're demanding different types of services, what does that mean? Two, then, you know, what services should Metrobus offer? You know, as a regional entity, are there more services or less services or different services that should be operated? What's the region's commitment to bus? Are we really prioritizing bus service here in the region, whether it's investments, again, in prioritization or BRT, the answer is probably no. There's a lot of work and room that can be done. And if your Metro bus sitting here thinking about the investment decisions you want to make as a board, making sure that the jurisdiction, your jurisdictional partners, are in fact giving you the tools to succeed for your customers at Metro bus is critically important. What are the business functions WMATA should provide? You know, there's been some conversation. Some of the stakeholders have said, for example, that they would like to see Metro take a more pronounced role in the planning of bus here in the region, for example. There may be other bus services or business services, marketing, for example, fare collection, where it makes sense for Metro to be the regional coordinator. There may be other business pieces that, in fact, the jurisdictions are better off operating. And then what are the regional structures needed? What kind of interventions does this board need to make? What kind of interventions do your regional partners need to make in order to make this happen? We have not seen, so around these, I think, five questions, we are now starting to do our analysis to come back to the committees, the public, and ultimately this board and Paul and his team for what we think your strategy moving forward should be. And the last slide is a final stake in where we are in terms of next steps. We expect to have a draft strategy out for public comment in mid-March to early April. Go through a process of hearing those final comments, putting together what we hope will be a regionally built consensus strategy, and then building a roadmap. Okay, once the strategy is in place, what is the plan over a 1, 3, 5, and 10 year? And that goes to the general manager's point, the budget implications for 2021 and beyond, and the capital implications. Thinking about where you're going to be making investments in vehicles and facilities potentially, or not as the case may be, depending on the type of services that the board and the team decide to run. So we'll stop there for any other further questions. We really appreciate your attention today. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We really appreciate your attention. If we could hesitate about 10, 15 minutes for questions, comments, members of the Safety and Operations Committee, comments, questions?
It's probably an aspiration because those who were going to be writing these strategic choices and recommendations, in fact, are not the folks that will be implementing that aspiration, right? So I think it's a good point. With that said, the various committees, the technical committee, the strategic advisory committee, representing your jurisdictional partners, devised that vision. So it's an aspiration that is from the region, not specifically from the consulting team of the ESC. So.
Good.
Thanks.
We can't have laughter at these official meetings.
I won't repeat my preamble. To what extent are you taking into account the emergence of municipal air travel when planning the future of bus in the region?
I mean, candidly, we haven't thought about that particular possible mode of transportation. I think our ambition is probably a little more short-term, to be candid. But we are thinking about AV, for example. How will that impact the bus? Is that a technology, for example, that either Metro Bus or, frankly, other regional partners should be looking at? We were meeting with Fairfax County yesterday. They put a grant in to run an AV shuttle in the county, for example. So, I think those are the kinds of things that we're thinking about, but happy to.
May I conclude with a request to council? Could council let the operating and safety committee know whether WMATA today has the legal authority to provide municipal air service on a retail basis, of course, right? Thanks.
Thank you very much, Mr. Horner. Any other, Mr. First, Mr. Committee, okay.
I want to follow up on David's first question, and I guess maybe to you, Rob. Beyond the aspirational statement, in your own words, what do you see as the goal and the purpose of the study?
If we can develop a cohesive, bold, regional strategy, that's a win, I think, for this committee. Because right now, this is probably the most complicated governance structure of any region in the country, right? So this isn't what they've been able to do in a Denver or in Atlanta, right, which is a little more straightforward. There's a lot of stakeholders in this region. There's a lot of elected officials. There's a lot of bus services being operated by local government. So if we can develop something that is regionally cohesive, but isn't watered down, as these things tend to be on a regional level, then that's certainly a win. I can tell you from the Executive Steering Committee's perspective, the idea is for more bus, not less. The folks recognize that it does have a strong role to play. There's nobody here who thinks, hey, it's going away, scooters are taking over, let's just double down on scooters. That's not the pervasive feeling, at least on the Executive Steering Committee. So trying to figure out how does it play out in a region that's changing rapidly, where the mobility landscape is changing rapidly, and with a governance structure that's as complicated as anywhere in the country, if we can develop a bold strategy that fits those parameters, I think that's a win for sure.
Okay. And could you give us a little insight to your discussion or the comments back on from the regional partners, the administrative folks, not the elected officials, but the people that are providing the service day to day? Give us some insight as to
what their concerns are about this. Yeah, and Rich can join too. I've been on all of these so far. These are happening literally this week, I think. We had some yesterday and last week. As I said, very sophisticated knowledge and understanding about what's going on. Very, as you can imagine, protective of the local service.
Right.
I have found a theme that's emerging with an understanding, at least in Virginia, with some of the races I've been on, a understanding that there is a good balance between regional and local services being provided by the jurisdictions. And there's a recognition of the harmony, may not be the right word, but the way that they work to get the balance between them, kind of what the local services are designed to do, some of us feeding the metro stations, what the regional services are designed to do, serving as high-capacity corridors. So, again, impressed by the sophistication of the discussion and a recognition that things need to change. We've asked that question very specifically. But not a lot of, I think, great ideas about what that change looks like. I think the folks are willing to recognize that we need to do something different, and they're willing to go with us on this process as we figure out what change would look like.
Okay. And given something you said earlier, the complexity of this region, given the three jurisdictions, has there ever been any talk? You mentioned privatization and some of the case studies you looked at. Has there been any talk, or has anyone mentioned, say, a regional governing board as it relates to bus or governing structure?
Speaking for myself, speaking from the conversation we've had with some of the stakeholders, I think there's a recognition that we have a lot of governance in the region, especially in Virginia. We have several regional bodies. And that does not appear to be a high priority for folks.
Okay. What about the equity issue? Highlighted several times here today, you looked at the maps you showed us, a lot of local provider coverage in Maryland and Virginia, not so much in the district. I think pretty much Metrobus is DC's bus system, above the circulator. Yeah. Any challenges there that you see moving forward or things you're going to have to really...
I think in terms of social equity, you mean making sure that folks are... I think it hasn't been stated this way, but there's a governing principle with the committee, at least, of do no harm, for sure. We want to make sure that bus doesn't become so great that it's only now serving folks who can afford it, right? That there is clearly a dependency that a lot of folks have on bus in the region, and this process has to do no harm to the folks who depend on it and probably should be augmenting the service they already have.
And one last question. The timeline you present and all that you're going to have to work through, General Manager states, we're going to be looking at this in the 21 budget. Is all of that realistic?
In terms of the project, I think it's certainly realistic. I mean, the consultant team is great. We're moving. This is a very involved process.
Okay.
We're not dragging our heels. In terms of the strategies, that's going to be seen, what we come up with. But that is the plan, is to affect things that are happening, not the current budget, right, but in the very, very near future, and then putting together those strategies in place to set the region up in the long term.
And I think to illustrate that point, that is why the request is for a 1, 3, 5, 10-year action plan. So there may be, let's say, less controversial, not expensive changes that can happen in the near term, but if there are those where there's going to be significant change, there's going to have to be a period in which there's an adoption period for a new service or for a change in service, I think that will probably be a more phased-in approach, if you will. The reality, too, is the steering committee has also said to the team as we're working through this, we want it to be bold, but we want it to be implementable, too. Right? So there are guardrails here. You need to be focused on what our civil rights requirements are and our ADA requirements. Right. And we have the 3% cap. So, think about the important guardrails, mm-hmm. not guardrails, but actually, protections for folks in this study as well.
Let me try to get a couple more questions if we need to keep the agenda moving. We'll hear from a couple of the members first that have not spoken. We'll come back to you, Mr. Goldman. Christian Dorsey. Mr. Dorsey.
I'll try to be quick. Thank you. I want to go back to the vision thing just so I understand it. Is the desire to have buses the mode of choice on the region's roads during the commuting period or during all periods?
It's a great question. I don't think the groups have actually focused on that, to be candid. Given what we said earlier, though, that your bus customers are, in fact, using bus throughout the day, not just during peak period, I think it would really be the latter. That would be a mode of choice throughout the day, given who's currently taking the services today. Now, of course, there will be potential cost impacts to that and others that we have to think about. But that would be my personal view, is yes, it would be throughout the day.
I mean, I would encourage you all to think about it because, quite frankly, if it is throughout the entire day, to me that seems to be a vision that is well beyond our reach. And while I'm always one to believe that your reach should exceed your grasp in order to be taken seriously and for us to, be able to evaluate good progress, I think it's important that the vision be realistic. And that really leads into the next question. A lot of this is about what we can do with the mode and the various operators of the modes, but it seems to me that the exogenous forces of changes in curbside management, congestion issues, as well as fuel prices, which create less of an advantage for bus over personal vehicle use. How are we thinking about how to bring attention to those issues? It seems that there's just a limit to what we can do with operating the mode, even though there's a lot of work that we can do there. But in order to truly realize that vision, a lot of other things need to be coordinated and change.
I'll say that at least with the steering committee, we are trying to look around the corner, trying to predict some of those things that we can't predict. As Rich said, we're looking at the effect of autonomous vehicles and the new mobility tools that are coming down the pipe. So those are certainly part and parcel of the conversations we've been having. Gas prices, not so much. I think, I don't know what the future is going to be for gas prices. Maybe we have some prediction, but to the extent that the committee would be able to predict or at least be cognizant of some of that, that would factor in. But there is certainly an understanding that things are changing. I mean, that's a basic tenet of how we're approaching this. With those changes that are happening, then how does bus fit into those larger expansions?
To put a finer point on it, Rob, is there any way that this project is going to create at least the roadmap for people to think about the things that maybe we can control, like curbside management? And, I know you mentioned TSP and perhaps dedicated lanes and other innovative factors. Is that all going to come together in terms of a regional strategy?
Indeed. That's the hope. I mean, I think we have to deal with some of those. And it gets into some of the governance questions, because some of the localities have different authorities over the roadway network. If we're thinking about bus-only lanes on a certain road that is governed by somebody else, well, there's a coordination that has to happen there. That might be easier for a local service, not so easy for the regional service. So all those things are part of the conversation right now. And I can tell you, it's a question that they do come up in these conversations with the stakeholders on the local level. They're very keenly aware of the curbs and the streets that they own and operate, and then the buses that are running on top of them. That's very much part of the car.
And as part of the community and stakeholder engagement, are we also purposefully identifying people who don't use bus to try and figure out why and to figure out what are the triggers that could and would get them to bus?
We are. Interestingly enough, in the survey, I believe the top three findings for folks not using the bus was, in fact, across all, maybe it's the next slide. Yes, so the barriers listed here are the system between frequent, occasional, and non-riders. So I suppose the good news here is that if you were tackling these three barriers, you should be able to grow your committed ridership and then also grow maybe your lack of committed ridership in frequent riders and non-riders.
Thank you.
Mr. Price, you had a question.
In the interest of time, I'll just
go sidebar. Okay, very good. Mr. Goldman? Yes, sir.
Yeah. Are you saying I'm going to be a filibuster of this week?
We need to keep this moving. We have another topic, so
this seems to no avail. There's a body of work that McKinsey had done some time ago. Has a team reviewed that, and if so, did you incorporate any of the findings from McKinsey?
We have reviewed that report. We are incorporating some of their findings. I think that report now is about 3 years old, as I recall. But we are incorporating those findings. We are.
All right. Very good. Mr. Goldman.
Thank you. In the earlier part of these conversations with Rich, I had raised three issues. And I just wanted to explore with you whether those issues, get your reaction to them, and whether they'll be addressed in the final document. The first is the idea of using smaller buses to try and get onto routes where more frequency might be a remedy for poor service. A second issue is microtransit pilots to try and get at the first mile, last mile type of riders where you don't want to put a bus of 40, 50 passengers out there. And the third issue is use of electric buses. I raised the electric bus issue because it's not addressed at all in any of your 50 or 60 slides. And it strikes me it's something that should be addressed as part of a regional solution to reducing carbon emissions. But second of all, at least what I've been advised is that in terms of operating costs, electric buses are cheaper to operate because they have less moving parts, so that there's less maintenance and that the use of electricity is a cheaper fuel than diesel or CNG. So I appreciate the comment on that. And actually, let me just throw out one more issue, which is triggered by the Kings County experiment, where Kings County has shown an increase in bus ridership in addition to the factors that you pointed out. Kings County is also one of the places around the country that has begun a program to subsidize low-income riders. And I'm just wondering if your research reveals whether the reduction in the cost for low-income riders has had an impact on that growth in ridership, and maybe that's something that should be considered in this area on a broader basis as a way to both protect those low-income riders and, in fact, produce an increase in their use of the bus system. So I'll leave you with those four issues to comment on.
Then quickly comment on those four because we have to continue to move on with the agenda. Thank
just
you.
Very quickly, the first two items we talked about on our executive committee call just this week. We've not really talked about electric buses. It makes sense for reasons you mentioned. We'll take that as a note for discussion.
And a reduction in cost, I would say, just referencing our conversation with Fairfax County yesterday, they rolled out a program to subsidize youth passes. They've seen a significant uptick in ridership among youth. So the answer is yes, we'll be looking at that as well. Again, cognizant that we have to make sure that our roadmap is realistic given the challenges that we
thank you. Appreciate that.
Thank you very much. One last question. Are there going to be any additional public forums or opportunities for the public to comment?
There will be. Once we put out a draft strategy, Mr. Chairman, we will have a public forum in each of the three jurisdictions for sure. We'll also take online comments, and then working through the four committees, the jurisdictional partners will have an opportunity to as well. And that will take, candidly, the reason why this process has been long is because we've been really deliberate when it comes to stakeholder engagement. The answer to your question is yes.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you very much. This was a great study. Thank you for the members of the board that had comments, questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, we're now going to shift gears and move to the question of the hours. I want to give the general manager an opportunity to set the stage for the discussion included in your initial comments, if you could comment on the Federal Transit Administration letter. And since we covered some of this material at our last meeting, perhaps what we would focus on today would be to really focus in on the options and then give the board an opportunity to ask questions about the options and the impact and how these options would impact our ongoing maintenance and capital improvement programs, as well as impact some of what the Federal Transit Administration has put forth. Mr. Chairman, General Manager.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me just step back. This program started roughly 18 months ago. At that time, what we proposed was we needed to get a better understanding of what we, you know, had, since we never had a preventive maintenance program in place. The board at that time decided to put a two-year window on this. So basically that's where we are. We're coming to that stage. We've made tremendous progress, as the data has shown, from both a safety perspective and reliability perspective by having these hours out there. There's a lot more work to be done. So that's why we had recommended that we continue for another year and revisit this next year. But we're also sensitive to the desires of the region, you know, to get more hours back. And so at our last meeting, we went and committed to come back in 30 days with some alternatives to look at, and that's what we've done. And so that's what we'll talk about, some of the implications of that, of just with the one pillar that we have, which is we're not going to back away from what it takes to keep the system safe, and the current hours that we have is what's required to do that. Whether we shift some of the things to do that, that's obviously in play, but what's not in play is backing away from the commitment to address these issues from a safety perspective. As you may recall, we did just recently get a letter from the FTA, dated January 18th, with some of their concerns with the hours issued. Let me just summarize them briefly. One is basically the potential for delaying review and approval of caps that have not been closed yet to date, because a lot of those are dependent upon the hours of work that you're doing out there. The second would be some of those that have closed, because they did that under the assumption that we were doing this level of maintenance out there, so they would want to take a look at that. This then, in effect, leads into the capital program potentially in 20, because some of the projects that we're doing there, they want to take a look at how does that fit into this overall strategy. And then the fourth element they raised was if the focus starts to shift of their resources to those issues, the potential impact they could have on the certification of the MSC, the Metropolitan Safety Commission. They're saying this in their role, their current role as the safety oversight, and that's why they have a role in this, to be sure. So I think it's just something that as the board discusses this and as the region discusses this issue, I think we have to keep in mind that this is a very big player in our world today, and obviously will be into the future.
Okay. Very good. Please.
Thank you. So starting coming here this morning, our purpose is to provide further explanation of the work done in the overnight window to highlight the work underway to improve the productivity, efficiency, and effectiveness of our track work, and to review four scenarios we proposed and the impact of reverting to our FY16 hours. For the chairman's request, I will move quickly through the first several slides that provide the background of what we do in terms of work in order to get to the options and discussion sooner. So just quickly, our progress on improving rail safety and reliability has really hinged on this shift from reactive to proactive work. We're doing that through reducing the amount of corrective work required and investing in new technology to reduce the work required or increase the efficiency of track access. These are long-term initiatives that we've started over the last 18 months that will continue over the next few years and truly are what is going to create more track time for us and help alleviate this tension between running service and doing the necessary work to keep the system safe and reliable. How is the overnight maintenance window used currently? Safe, reliable service requires sufficient time for maintenance and capital renewal. That is a message we have been bringing to you consistently for the last 2 years. And really, our overnight window is used primarily for inspections, for our preventive maintenance programs, and for our capital program. Our preventive maintenance programs were initiated 18 months ago, as Mr. Wiedefeld said, in FY18. And they target two particular issues, our electrical fires, as these are our highest severity, highest risk incidents, and our track defects. These are our lower severity but higher frequency, meaning the most problematic when it came to running consistent, reliable service. These programs are at various states of completion, as shown on the slide here. That's where we are through November. As you can see on electrical fires, we are approximately a third of the way through that program. And for the track defects, we're a little more than halfway. Both programs, all six of these programs, require more time in order to complete even the first pass of the system, and many of which are things we think should be sustained on an ongoing basis. For the capital program, we have many different crews that use the overnight window, including advancing our capital program, our state of good repair, and investing in new technology, as well as closing the aforementioned FTA and NTSB corrective action plans. Our capital program has increased dramatically. Our capital work wrench hours are up over 300% from FY16 to now. So when we came to you with these hours 2 years ago, we were focused on preventive maintenance. But since then, the capital program truly has increased to be a much bigger proportion of the work executed overnight. Now, approximately half of the work we do every night after revenue service is actually capital in nature. So track time is our most scarce resource. And we spend a lot of our time and focus on figuring out how to maximize that resource. A significant portion of the non-passenger time is actually not able to be used for work. This is a graphic we have shown before that shows the time required from when we officially say we have the end of passenger service. Trains are actually still moving through the system for up to an hour afterwards. That is people who are continuing on their journey and actually not exiting the system for another 45 minutes, as well as the trains needing to get back to a yard. We then have the time required to set up a safe work zone and protect the crews and bring down power, which leaves us with approximately 2 to 2.5 hours of productive work time in a 5 to 5.5 hour window. So increasing service, increasing our hours of service without compromising safety and reliability will require us to focus on increasing the productivity of those crews during their productive work window, increasing the efficiency of right-of-way access, reducing that orange box, and increasing the effectiveness of the work. Are we making sure that our crews are doing the right tasks at the right frequency to achieve a state of good repair and right size our maintenance plans?
But it begs the question of you already working at productivity and efficiency. How much work do you squeeze of the crews?
We think over time we can. We are investing new technologies that would allow us to be more efficient in how we access the tracks and allow those crews to get out there earlier. We're also looking at other tools to help the crews be more productive during that time. But those investments are things that take time, as it requires investment, exploration and investment in new technology, new processes and training. That's not something we can turn on overnight. So progress has been made on these fronts. We've increased our work production by almost doubling our work wrench hours, so actual productive hours executed overnight since 2016. We went from being approximately 27,000 hours per quarter to now well over 40, approaching 50,000 hours executed per quarter. Progress is also being made on work efficiency. We've improved our wrench time. We're allowing people to get out there and have a longer productive work window. We've changed our work approach to have larger crews to enable us to be more efficient once they are working. And we're able to put out more crews on the roadway every night. And that has been a significant increase in allowing us to make best use of this overnight window. So our challenge here is truly balancing service and maintenance. As Mr. Wiedefeld has commented, we are going to maintain our commitment to safety and to achieving a state of good repair. So what we seek to present here is options for you to consider balancing the interest in late night service with the risks to progress on safety and reliability. Any increase in service hours will reduce the time available 4-hour work, which could have a negative impact on those, on that progress made, negatively impact the capital program, and potentially increase net costs to the jurisdictions. So looking at the timing and how we develop the options, what we looked at is how do we time the work window. In order for crews to have a productive work window out there of at least 2 hours, we need to have a 5-hour window of track time in order to clear the train, set up a work zone, get people to work, and clear them and restore service. So the chart we have here tracks by half hour how many people would be affected in the following 5 hours if we were to set up a track work event at that time. As you can see, the impact is clearly highest in the mornings and in the evenings when we affect peak rush hour. But even midday single tracking from 10 to 2, used to do several years ago, still is at risk of impacting up to 100,000, 110,000 riders. Our overnight windows are currently already aligned with the lows that you see on the far right. Our lowest weekday ridership impact is at 11:30 p.m. We have less than 2,000 riders that would be affected in the following 5 hours. And on the weekends, that's at 1:30 a.m. So modifying our overnight work windows will impact more riders if we shift it in any direction. So preventive maintenance programs, as I alluded to earlier, these are things that are still ongoing, and we are committed to maintaining these programs, irrespective of our service hours, because we believe they are necessary to promote safety and reliability. If we do revert back to our FY16 hours, these programs will have to be done during passenger service in order to maintain schedule and frequencies, which we believe we need. This means more midday single tracking and potentially late night bus bridges, as three of these programs actually require both tracks to be out of service. So reverting to FY16 hours will reduce the maintenance time. When we asked for these hours 2 years ago, it was our explanation then that by removing 8 hours from service, we can double our productive time. Therefore, if we revert back, we will lose half the productive time we have now. And no amount of single tracking can make up for that reduction in the overnight maintenance window. And the reason that is true is that it's the number of crews we send out. On a typical weeknight, we send on average 48 crews. If we are single tracking, we can do maybe up to 3 crews within that work zone. And in terms of our operational constraints, we can do maybe 3 single tracking zones at a time. So that's 9 crews that could maybe recoup some hours as opposed to the 48 that would face a reduction. So if we revert back to FY16, we estimate 75% of our crews would lose track time and have to extend their schedules. We did want to touch on, at the request of the board, late night alternative mobility context. There is bus service that is available in these hours. When we made this change, we invested $2 million in increased late-night metro bus service, and we supplemented the existing service on 30 routes to ensure that we had a total of 89 routes with service at midnight, and 17 of those provide service past 3 a.m. So now we can get into the details of the alternatives proposed. Our first scenario that we have is the revert to FY16 hours. On the top, you can see that would leave us at 5 a.m. to midnight, Monday to Thursday. Friday, 5 a.m. to 3 a.m. Saturday and Sunday, we would open at 7 a.m. and close at 3 a.m. and midnight, respectively. I do want to acknowledge we need a small correction on this chart. That would result in 8 hours return to service instead of 7.5. What that means, though, for our work is that it would be a 44% loss of our work wrench hours, looking at if we'd implemented these hours for the first quarter of FY19. In addition, we would need rail service adjustments, so track work during passenger service hours, to maintain the PM programs. And those changes lead us to reduce our customer on-time performance target. 80% of our customers, we think, will get to their destination on time from our current 88% down to 83% and force us to cancel our rush hour promise program. And the ridership impact is that we could add 0.6 million trips in the added hours, we would lose an estimated 11.6 million trips due to the track work in the midday and evening hours for a net loss of 11 million trips annually. Alternative A is to shift the hours, so maintain the same number of service hours, same number of overnight hours, and shift them to end at 3 a.m. on the weekends and end at midnight on the weekdays. From a work wrench hour perspective, this is a small loss in hours due to the scheduling of crews and how long each night ends up, about a 3% loss of productive work time. We would make this up through limited additional weeknight single tracking. We maintain our customer on-time performance target at 88%. We would see an addition of 0.6 million trips in late night, same as in the reverse scenario. But we would lose 3.1 million trips in the morning for a net loss of 2.5 million trips per year. Second alternative B, is to extend just the weekend hours. We would extend Friday and Saturday nights till 2 a.m., and on Sunday, we would restore the hour of service in the morning from 7 to 8 a.m. and extend to 11:30, returning 3.5 hours from the overnight window to passenger service. This is a higher quantity of work wrench hours lost. About 9% of our productive time would be lost, and we would make this up through additional weekend single tracking. Again, this is related to the length of the window on each night. However, we'd still be able to maintain our customer on-time performance target at 88%, and we would have a net increase of 0.4 million trips per year and no trips lost, as we've not reduced any hours. And finally, alternative C is our proposal to maintain our current service hours, which results in no changes to the RSAs, to the OTP target, and no cost increase relative to our current budget. So the FY20 budget impacts of these service alternatives are shown here in this table. These would start in FY20 and presumably continue beyond. And reverting to FY16 entails significant additional costs. These costs are the additional costs for bus bridges and RSA, the Rail Service Adjustment Support, the loss of fare revenue associated with lost ridership in the midday and evening hours, and the fact that we do not anticipate any significant savings from those service reductions, as they will be highly variable and moving throughout the system, changing week to week. In total, the revert to FY16 hours has a net FY20 cost forecast at $45 million. Alternative A is forecast at $9 million. Alternative B at $3.5 million. Alternative C, zero.
Just a question. Are these costs considered within the 3% cap, or are they beyond the cap?
This would be beyond the cap.
So we would have to find that money.
Okay. Thank you. So coming back to our summary table, we've put now all of the information here on one slide. Looking to the added rows, when we include the net cost to the jurisdictions, you can see the numbers under each scenario. Per the board request, we also looked at these in terms of the cost per trip added to understand how they might compare. So the revert to FY16 hours is about $72 per trip added. For alternative A, we would be spending about $15 per trip added. Alternative B is $10 per trip added. And alternative C does not apply. In terms of other risks, we see that with the reversion to FY16 hours, we would have significant capital program delays. And our NTSB and FTA caps that have been closed or in the process of being closed would be at risk. For alternative A, we do need to explore the requirements for a public hearing, as there would be hours of service being cut, as well as need to revisit some of our labor union work rules. Alternative B would see some capital program delays, and alternative C does not face these risks. So in summary, as I recognize that is a lot of data we put onto one chart, we tried to simplify and pull back to a higher level summary for your discussion. So alternatives A, B, and C each have their merits. Here what we've compared is if we're looking to prioritize late-night ridership, alternative A provides the most increase in late-night ridership. If you're looking at total ridership as the priority, alternative B has the best impact, most positive impact on total ridership. And if we were looking to cost or to the impact of track work, particularly our capital program and staying within our 3% cap, then alternative C best meets those two metrics. With that, I open it up to questions.
Very good. We really appreciate that. Now, what I would like to do is to open the time up to first to our committee and then to the other members of the board who are present. Again, thank you very much for the presentation. Well done, well organized. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Mason, I too want to thank you for your presentation. I thought it was really well done. I'll just make a comment. I know from the Virginia perspective at this point, I think the general manager's focus on safety, getting the system to a state of even better repair. We have the safety commission issues that are highlighted in the FTA letter. We have financial considerations, I know, from Virginia jurisdictions because of the way we're funded or the way we contribute to the system. I know the jurisdictions simply do not have any more money to put into it at this point. And I think getting the system in a state of good repair is paramount, and I think extending the hours at this point in time could harm that. It's not to say that after a year and a half or 2 years that we wouldn't consider that again. We'd all like to see that, obviously, ultimately. But I think now the importance or the emphasis should be on safety. And I think it would be really difficult to go out to the public. For instance, this coming summer, there's going to be shutdowns. All the stations in Alexandria are going to be closed. How do you go out and say, oh, we're extending hours, and yet you're not going to have access to your stations for three and a half months? I think that's a hard message. So those are my general comments at this point.
Thank you. Yes, please. Now, yes. Are we?
Committee members?
Mr. Stavage, you have?
No.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I'm glad we're getting this thoughtful presentation on the alternatives here. I'm troubled, though, that what's not on the agenda here is a resolution that would keep in place the current service hours and therefore the current maintenance hours. It's appropriate for this board to have a debate on best of these or other potential alternatives, but the starting point for that debate should not be a 44% decrease in the maintenance hours for this system. That puts this system at risk. The starting point for this debate should be something that protects the maintenance hours, doesn't lose ridership, doesn't lose us tens of millions of dollars that we have to find from the jurisdictions. We're not going to pony that up. I think it's very irresponsible that we're on a path now where the no-action scenario is this nightmare of going back to the bad old days of letting this system rot and then telling the financial folks, you know, figure it out. At the dentist, they tell you, you don't have to floss all your teeth, just the ones you want to keep. We have not been flossing and brushing this system for years. We are in the midst of a painful visit to the dentist because of all that neglect. And everything we saw in this presentation, we are only partway done with this project. We've got to catch up on the neglect of the past. We've got to get a new, responsible, ongoing maintenance program in place so that this system can serve riders. And that's not going to happen if we let the default scenario go into effect on July 1st. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. McMillan. Any other comments from any of the...
Well, I'll make a comment.
Yes, please.
Thank you. And I appreciate everything everyone has said to this point, and certainly the alternatives being presented. The reason we're not going forward with a resolution today is General Manager, Mr. Wiedefeld, will be making this exact presentation at the Mayor Council breakfast, the 29th, I think it is, so that everyone in the district, and that's a breakfast for all the council members, the mayor, staff, everybody is there, will have an opportunity to see the presentation and weigh what it is that is at stake here. And after that, I will then, myself and Mr. Price, will then have our instructions, so to speak, as to which of these alternatives the district is willing to support. I can make the argument on both sides. I can argue why we should stay where we are, and I can argue why we should go back to the way it was. The District of Columbia is the most affected in many ways by not having the late hours, although Virginia has an active nightlife, as does Merrill. Customers, but more importantly, the people who work in the establishments, the hotels, the restaurants, the office buildings, whatever it is, rely a lot on our subway system to get home. Not the buses, and certainly not Uber and Lyft and taxis, which are way too expensive. And so have patiently for the last 2 years found other alternatives, but their patience is run out. And so at least in the jurisdiction I represent, I would not only not have a hard time explaining why we went back, that is what people are advocating for. And so there are, you know, many ways to look at this issue. But after the 29th, the presentation, the district will have a better idea of where we come down on these alternatives. So at that point, we will come back and let everybody know. But rest assured, I understand the arguments on all sides about needed track time, about the money that's involved. And the money is a big issue given the federal shutdown in this regard. The District of Columbia is going to lose, if this continues till, which it will, next first week in February, I think we're looking at $85 million downgrade in our revenue. Add to that the $400,000 a day Metro's losing. Our share of that is 37%, as Maryland and Virginia are going to have to share in that expense as well. So the costs are mounting. And on the businesses in the city, the sales tax is way off. The customers are way down. And if they don't get their late night hours back, they saw a shortfall when the late night hours were removed. It's another burden on everyone. So these are tough times. And so there are tough decisions have to be made. So it's just observations. I have no decision today and won't until after the mayor council breakfast and we have an idea of where we're going to come down on this. But I think it's important my colleagues and the mayor get this presentation because it's very powerful and it does lay out all the options. Thank you.
Any other comments or questions, Mr. Dorsey?
Thank you. So, my perspectives very much reflect what we've heard from Mr. Smedberg, Mr. McMillan. Thank you very much. But a question, General Manager, you posited at some point before that Metro would be the convener of conversations about what might be some other alternatives beyond our lifeline bus service to meet the needs of, I think, what we've calculated as roughly 3,000 riders per weekend or per weekend night. So have we had any progress with that? Is there anything that you can share at this point?
Yes, we have been doing some work looking at really the guaranteed ride home program that the Washington Council of Governments has. I think it's something that we would propose if the district, feels that that's an alternative that they would want to for us to pursue. Because at the end of the day, that seems to be the core issue we've got to get to. But I think there are all other alternatives, whether or not we guarantee some sort of base price, whether we work with the restaurant community, for instance, and register people that need the rides home and then come up with a program that then supports that. All those things I think we could do. But the larger discussion of just the overall rail hours is really the issue, because as you know, we do already provide the bus service. We increase that. There is some concern that that's not getting to the core issue. And so that's why we haven't, implemented anything of that sort, but it's definitely something that we could do if that's, the prerogative of the region.
And I just think it bears repeating. So, you know, 600,000 trips on an annual basis are, you know, would be gained by shifting the hours. You know, we gave each of those individuals $10 for that trip. That's $6 million. And we're looking at alternatives that are far less efficient. You know, just to echo Mr. McMillan, this is the wrong way to go about solving a customer service problem of inadequate opportunities to travel in the region. We can be a lot more focused and a lot more effective while not compromising the other however many million trips happen on Metro Rail every year. Yes, Mr. Goldman.
I just wanted to underscore what Mr. Dorsey was saying about looking at something in terms of a other kind of a solution, because while even the cheapest solution, alternate B, would cost $4 million to accommodate 400,000 or roughly about 1,100, 1,200 passengers a night, late night between 2 and 3 a.m., we've got a pot of money already of $2 million that we're using for this late night service. If we use that for some kind of subsidy program, you know, we'd essentially be able to give people $5 a trip. If we could get the restaurateurs and barkeepers to match that, we'd be able to give people $10 a trip. If they're already spending $2 on Metrobus to get home, they've got $12 a trip. I can't believe that some kind of operation with Uber and Lyft, Lyft Line, or Uber Pool, we couldn't accommodate these 1,100, 1,200 people a night with a more efficient, convenient service than we're currently providing at with the late-night buses and an alternative that would be able to preserve our current total use of the hours for preventive maintenance and preventive maintenance and capital programs. So I would really urge you, as general manager, to staff to look into this and try and...
No, we have. And the model is the Guaranteed Ride Home program. And in effect, you could apply that same model to this portion of the marketplace. That's fairly straightforward to do. But I think, again, I think this is a larger discussion about the role rail plays in the overall image of the region and of the district. And so I think those are other issues that need to be addressed. So it's fairly straightforward how we could get there if that's where, you know, the region wants to go. But I think it's a broader discussion that we're having here.
Are there any other comments or questions? If not, then I will just close out with a couple of comments. I think that for our committee and for the board in general, we have, I would argue, three primary responsibilities. Provide a safe system, provide a reliable system, provide an affordable system. And I think, as we had talked before, all of the easy solutions have already been done. We're now faced with hard ones. And I recall a lesson I learned when I was just a puppy at IRS, and I was working for a very senior executive, and he told me the general rule to problem solving is real simple. Make sure that your solution isn't worse than the problem that you're addressing. So I think we've heard some ideas here about perhaps looking at guaranteed ride home. We don't want to disrupt a lot of people, and we clearly do not want to backtrack. The oversight organization, if you read the letter, one of the reasons why meeting this date is so important is that it not only affects Metro, but it affects funding to all of Maryland, Virginia, and D.C., which I think is around over $600 million would be in jeopardy if we miss this date. So I think as we look at these alternatives, I'm hopeful that we will craft a good way forward that makes good sense. If by chance we look at alternatives that would potentially impact maintenance or cause the
FTA to divert resources, that we would check with them to make sure we understand whether doing X or Y would cause them to have to divert resources so that we understand what the risks are. I'm hopeful that we will come to a good conclusion. In fact, I'm confident we will come to a good conclusion. It's just the balance. It's the short-term benefit versus the long-term goal in terms of providing a safe, reliable, affordable system. If there are no other comments, so what we will do is, Mr. Evans said, the CEO and Mr. Evans will make the presentation to the district leadership, and it's anticipated then that in the month of February, we will be in a position to make a vote, and I'm confident we'll make the right decision as to what we want to do. You are the expert, so again, your position, your thoughts about what we, again, just reaffirming where you stand as the experts and the providers of the service would be, I think, very helpful to the board to have as we make that decision. I want to thank the board very much for taking the time to consider this and to weigh all of the issues. And as I say, I'm confident we will find a way forward. No other comments or questions? We will adjourn at this time.